The skies in California are coated in smoke as hundreds of fires burn.
It was coming up over the hill back behind me and just raging and up in a big red line and just coming quick.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway from Monday, August 24th, a look at the fires burning across California and how resources are already stretched thin. Then, residents of Flint, Michigan are set to receive a settlement for suffering from the effects of lead in their water.
The effects that this has done to us mentally, psychologically, physically, on so many levels, it's just a great first step, but it's definitely not enough.
Also, what's herd immunity and whether it can work for tackling COVID-19? And we wrap up the show with a look at how one Black writer is grappling with racism when camping. All right, let's get started.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Coming down the street, the first house was on fire, and then my neighbor's house was on fire, and it was gone, and I was thought for sure mine was gone, but it's not, and it's a God bless.
We're up in the hills. We just finished helping put out the fires at my two neighbors' place in the back. So we're worried about the eucalyptus trees are going to catch fire and then we have a disaster.
It's difficult. You know that you just need the bare essentials and everything else could be replaced. And it's overwhelming. You just want to grab one more thing and you can't.
Well, no more, but pretty much I'm thinking we're going to lose the house.
There's a lot going on, the coronavirus and the heat wave and then the power outages and now the fire. But we're tough people. You know, we're persevere.
I'm really worried because if it burns down the next few days, I don't have a place to live.
Hundreds of fires are raging across California, displacing residents, filling the air with smoke, and putting enormous pressure on firefighters. Some of the fires are among the largest the state has ever seen. The fires follow heat waves and what scientists believe might be the highest temperature ever recorded on Earth, 130 degrees Fahrenheit in Death Valley National Park. At the same time, the state continues to fight COVID-19, adding an extra layer of complication both to fighting the fires and to the evacuation process. And with the windy season still to come this fall, California is bracing for what could be weeks of disaster and recovery. Jacob Margolis is a science reporter at KPCC covering disasters in California. Jacob, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How do you put these fires in context, Jacob, compared to other fires in California that we've seen over the past few years?
2019 was the respite. Last year was. 2017, 2018, and now 2020 are some of our worst fire years on record. They've certainly produced some of the largest fires we've ever had. Two fires that are burning right now in Northern California have already, they're not even beyond 25% contained, and they've already climbed to the top. I think they're at 2 and 3 on that biggest fire ever list. So I would say that these are extremely concerning, scary, made only possible by climate change. And going forward, Californians definitely have to decide how we want to tackle this sort of thing, because clearly fires of this size are going to keep happening, and we don't have the resources to continue fighting them on this scale.
You mentioned climate change. I was going to ask you, what do we think is spurring the intensity of these fires this year? Is it climate change specifically? Is it human activity? Do we know what may have caused this initial fire that's now become hundreds of fires?
Yeah. So climate change has made all of this possible in that we're experiencing extreme heat. We're experiencing drought conditions across much of Northern California, and that sets the stage for then fires to burn through these areas that are particularly verdant up in that Northern California area. The fuels are very large, so you have very large trees that are ready to burn. On top of that, yes, the answer is also that we are we have a housing problem in this state, and people are continuing to build more and more out into wilderness, and that makes people more and more vulnerable, especially as fires become more and more common. There was a stat from the Fourth National Climate Assessment that was released in 2018 that said in the western U.S., we've had double the amount of fires that we otherwise would have had if climate change were not a factor. So it's definitely something that we're contending with here and something that's having disastrous consequences.
Jacob, it's also record temperatures in California over the past couple of weeks. That can't be helping at all.
No, absolutely not. I mean, not only do you have, I think about all of the people, especially in Northern California right now, and this is true for a lot of folks throughout the state, especially people who maybe can't afford to have air conditioning, maybe don't have, you know, there are options for some to hunker down at home, seal off their doors and windows and run the air conditioning, and hopefully, you know, the fire doesn't come towards them. But then there are plenty of people that don't have that option. You have unhoused people, you have people that just live in Northern California that don't usually need air conditioning. And so they're having to choose between, you know, opening the windows, being inundated with smoke and trying to cool things down, which is obviously not going to work, or keeping things closed and keeping their lungs, their families, whatnot, healthy. It's a really awful situation to be in. And then also you, of course, and, you know, we have to mention people that don't have the option to hunker down, period, and have to go out and work. You have a lot of farm workers right now throughout California that provide the nation with a whole lot of produce, who are very important, who are not being provided with proper PPE, who are out in the fields working through all of this. And that's really scary for them, too.
It's an interesting point there, because I'm wondering, I recall when we were covering other fires last year, I think the Camp Fire and others, there were real interesting, Jacob, breakdowns in terms of which communities were affected, which communities could afford to hire their own private firefighters, and which communities, particularly low-income communities, were, you know, seeking shelter where they could. So a couple questions for you. Are we seeing these fires hitting certain communities harder than others? Are poorer communities being hit harder than wealthier communities? And if so, what are the recovery efforts looking like so far?
You know, wildfire insurance is quite expensive in the state. There was a piece of, it was either legislation or California Insurance Commissioner passed something last year that stopped insurance companies from dropping people in high risk zones for wildfires. You know, the plain truth is that even after these fires move through, people could spend years picking their lives back up. And there was a fire earlier this summer that, you know, we were one of the few outlets that covered it, down in Nyland, which is in Imperial Valley, and particularly a low-income area. It burned through this one town. A lot of homes, trailer homes, burned down. And as of a couple of weeks ago, I was still reaching out to people who were living in hotels, put up into hotels by the Red Cross. And for people like that, that don't have fire insurance, that are going to try to get some federal aid, but oftentimes that federal aid takes a really long time to come through if you're able to get it at all. You know, people have to kind of move and start doing stuff on their own. And that might mean leaving the community altogether. And for a community like Nyland down in Imperial Valley, a very tight-knit community, that's really sad. But the truth is that a lot of communities don't recover from these fires, and not everybody can afford to rebuild.
Jacob, we're dealing nationally and globally with a COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic, which has to have complicated recovery efforts and shelters and exacerbated the situation down there, particularly because COVID-19 is a respiratory illness primarily. So how is that affecting where people can shelter and their overall health?
In terms of where they can shelter, up until these mega fires that are occurring right now, the Red Cross, which runs a lot of shelters, had been putting people up in hotels. What we're starting to see on this mega fire, on these two mega fires actually, are that people are actually camping out in tents at some shelters. People are staying in their cars. There are some, you know, shelters are implementing social distancing, but it also seems that people are trying to do that on their own. It's difficult when you have an entire region on fire where you cannot escape the smoke, you cannot escape the wildfires, because you don't have the option to go to a friend's house or a family's house. Like I mentioned, Nyland, a lot of those people also went to friends and family's houses to hunker down. And that's what you see on a lot of smaller fires. And when I say smaller, I'm really thinking something under 50,000 acres, which is absolutely absurd because that is also a huge fire. I mean, I don't know any other way to put into context just how devastatingly large these fires are than that they're the largest on record. So people are doing what they can. And in terms of respiratory stuff, I've been talking to a lot of scientists about wildfire smoke inhalation. I haven't seen any sort of direct correlation between inhalation and increased risk of contracting COVID, but there have been some, that idea has been floated and it's being looked at as a potential risk. But wildfire smoke is unbelievably toxic. And if you have COVID or are, you know, possibly, I don't know, if you catch COVID and you've been inhaling massive amounts of wildfire smoke, I imagine there is probably consensus on this, that you're in not good shape.
What about the people who are fighting these fires? We know that California in particular relies a lot on inmates to fight fires. And there, as I mentioned earlier, there are some people who have the resources to hire their own private firefighters. So what does that look like in terms of the folks who are actually battling these fires?
Yeah, I mean, the vast majority of people cannot afford private firefighters in California. I mean, I know we certainly can't. We had to evacuate last year. And, you know, for the public force, you know, the force that's available to everyone, it's absolutely maxed out. Even before these fires hit, I was talking to some Cal Fire Riverside folks, and they were saying that their people already had burnout because this is such an active fire season already. And they're also dealing with COVID and going out on calls dealing with COVID. And they do a lot of 911 calls, even though they're the state fire agency. And, you know, that is really concerning for them. I mean, 14 hours on, 2 days, or 14 days on, 2 days off is usually their schedule. And when you have fires this early, I mean, it's not even peak fire season. We're approaching Santa Ana season, and when you get these wind-driven fires, it's going to be absolutely devastating again because it's been so dry. And if you're already seeing burnout amongst those firefighters, I mean, you could just imagine by the time October, November, December, if rains come along at all, I mean, we could be burning into winter, which happened in 2017 with the Thomas Fire. It wasn't extinguished until January.
Jacob Margolis, science reporter at KPCC, covering disasters in California. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from Californians. How are you dealing with fires and planning for them? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Last week, Michigan announced that a preliminary agreement was reached to settle multiple lawsuits against the state for its role in the Flint water crisis. If the settlement is approved, up to $600 million could be made available to Flint residents who have suffered the effects of lead poisoning after a city's water supply was redirected in 2014. Roughly 80% of the funds are earmarked for children, with the vast majority going to residents who were under the age of 6 at the time of their exposure. The settlement still has to be approved by a federal judge. And this leaves Flint residents continuing to grapple with the lifelong consequences of lead exposure as they await the opportunity for some financial relief. Joining me now is Leon El Alamin, founder and executive director of the MADE Institute, a nonprofit based in Flint that works with formerly incarcerated people. Hi, Leon. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And Nayira Sharif is the director of Flint Rising, an environmental justice organization. Nayira, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with you, Nayira. What reactions have you been hearing from members of the Flint community about the terms of the settlement so far?
A sense of closure, shock, anger, and I would say most importantly, like the realization that this monetary compensation will not be enough to deal with the long-term physical and mental health impacts that our community is facing as a result of the largest public health disaster in the history of the United States.
Remind us what some of the health effects are that you and others have suffered because of the Flint water crisis.
Well, myself, I now have non-epileptic seizures. I have severe asthma for the past 3 years. I have also gotten pneumonia because of the upper respiratory issues I now face on a daily basis.
Leon, how do you feel about the terms of the settlement so far?
It's mixed. On one end, it's a sense of some form of closure. But on the other end, as you read through so far what's been presented to the public, it's some concerns. As you read into how the distribution of funding, some requirements currently right now for adults to be compensated is a major issue. On a personal level with me in particular, I feel like everyone who was here was affected in some kind of way, and there shouldn't be any stipulations or red tape to accessing any compensation that may be coming. The effects that this has done to us mentally, psychologically, you know, physically, on so many levels, it's just a great first step, but it's definitely not enough. And I'm gonna be looking forward to continuing the process of litigation and looking to drive this issue in the courts with others.
So I want to talk a little bit about a couple points that you just raised, Leon, because you mentioned that according to the settlement, children who were exposed to lead are presumed to have suffered an injury. But adults need to submit a different form of proof before they get any compensation from this. Nayira, what do you make of that? I mean, you are someone who has suffered physical injury from this water crisis.
Fighting for first the restoration of democracy and then fighting for acknowledgement that there was lead in the water and fighting for just like the long-term reparations for this community has consumed 9 years of my life. And for me, it echoes back when we were fighting for acknowledgement that there was something wrong with our water. And also now that we have to prove that we were adversely impacted using census data and using the portion of the settlement that adults will be eligible for is about $1,200. And that is like a blatant insult.
Why do you say that it's an insult? Is it because the cost of your care, it far exceed the settlement payment that you would get, or other reasons?
The amount. And then also the things that this community has been advocating for as a result of the water crisis is not in existence in the settlement. We wanted lifetime health care for all residents because we are not sure what's going to manifest as we age. And one of the other things we also wanted was for everyone's pipes to be replaced, all of their internal plumbing to be replaced. And that also is not in the settlement.
Leon, you mentioned earlier that you're interested in seeing this battle continue to be played out in the courts. The proposed settlement would resolve most of the claims against the state, but there's still an ongoing criminal probe into the official response. What do you want to see happen here?
In regards to everyone that was involved from the federal, state, local, and county levels, if they knew about it, played a role and had their hands in it, became quiet behind it, they need to be prosecuted as well. This has really affected our community on so many levels, divided us, exhausted us. People have left because they can't continue to deal and move forward with this type of trauma on top of what we're dealing with COVID and so forth now. So definitely there needs to be criminal charges brought to everyone that is involved with the KWA, the water source that we was originally trying to get tapped onto before the switch came on down, you name it. They all had a hand in it. We've seen some individuals who are benefiting politically off of it. And that rubs me the wrong way, and a lot of residents in this city the wrong way, and seeing how this is played out. And it's unfortunate, you know, because we can quickly incarcerate and charge individuals for selling weed and things like that and not clear their records after this has been made legal. But here we are, a city that has been poisoned, and individuals, over 100 individuals have died, and people are still sick and suffering, and we still don't know the long-term effects, and no one has been charged. Charges has been dropped. This is a political chess move at the same time, and individuals are just finding a way to get from up under it, and I think that's a tragedy. And we definitely want to see criminal charges taking place.
Nayira, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer released a video statement shortly after the settlement was announced, and here's a little bit of what she had to say.
We recognize that the settlement may not completely provide all that Flint needs, and that many will still feel justifiable frustration with a system and structure that at times is not adequate to fully address what has happened to the people in Flint over the last 6 years. We hear and respect those voices and understand that healing Flint will take a long time.
Your response?
It really seems very pat, because I know that I have personally spoken to the governor multiple times, and we had organized multiple waves of Flint residents to talk about the reparations and justice that they deserve. I guess, like, I'm tired of dragging my lead poisoned body all over the country to try to get justice, because it's always on people who have been traumatized to advocate for, you know, the ending of their own trauma.
The city, as well as the rest of the country, is still dealing with the COVID-19 global pandemic. How has that affected what's already been a community that's been disproportionately hurt by poisoned water?
More trauma on top of trauma. And we have a health crisis on top of a health crisis. We're losing more people. People are dying, lives that can't be replaced. This has psychologically and physically worn us out. For the state and other individuals want us to continue to just accept apologies and whatever little bit of compensation and the other hoops and hurdles that you got to go through, I think is an insult. You get to a point to where you want to break. You're tired. The effects of the lead and COVID is wearing itself out on us. And it's really a tragedy, you know, to just have individuals to come on and give nice speeches. Kind of back even when we have former President Obama came to Flint Northwest, and I was there front row and, you know, made the attempt as if he was drinking the Flint water. That was an insult. What they should be happy that hasn't happened is what we see in Minnesota, what we see in Portland, when enough is enough.
Leon, you have a young son. How has he been affected by the lead crisis and the upheaval and everything else that's been happening?
Oh, man, you know, it's a struggle every day being a single parent, raising my son. You know, he was affected from his skin, the rashes, the hair loss. And then I'm just monitoring his development as we move forward. I had an opportunity to get him away from the Flint water the last few years, and just trying to recover and just see his development. I'm really paying attention to it. It's something I'm monitoring, but it's been a struggle. It's a struggle going to the doctors, you know, medical bills, you name it.
Leon El-Alamin is the executive director of the MAID Institute, which works with formerly incarcerated individuals. And Nayira Sharif is the director of Flint Rising, an environmental justice organization. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Since the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, we've heard the phrase herd immunity a lot. It's often touted as a way to end the spread of the virus. The theory is that herd immunity happens when enough people become protected against a virus, either through vaccines or infection. Scientists initially estimate that about 70% of the population would need immunity for this to work. But in recent weeks, more than a dozen scientists told the New York Times that the threshold to herd immunity could actually be much lower, around 45 to 50% of the population in some communities. So while there's still uncertainty about how herd immunity works in the COVID-19 context, it could be a bit closer than researchers initially expected. For more on this, I'm joined by Apoorva Mandavilli, science reporter at the New York Times, and Jeffrey Shaman, professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Apoorva, let's start with you. What do we mean when we talk about herd immunity in the context of COVID-19?
Well, as you mentioned, herd immunity is the concept that enough people are protected from a pathogen, in this case, the coronavirus, that they have some level of immunity, either by having had the infection once or by having gotten a vaccine. And the idea is that when you get to that level, the virus starts to run out of people to infect and slows down in circulation. And so we get to a point where we see fewer and fewer outbreaks. Not none, but fewer and slower.
Jeff, are there different types of herd immunity? I mean, can you explain the difference between the natural, i.e. getting the virus and then having antibodies, and the vaccine-related version of this?
Sure, they're a bit related. So in the natural course of an outbreak, people are being infected and there's transmission from person to person. Provided that the people who have been infected, once they've recovered from it, develop antibodies that confer some kind of protection, and they have other components of the memory system as well, the memory immune system. But if that confers protection, those people, at least for a time, are going to be out of circulation when it comes to being infected with the virus again or transmitting it. They're removed from the whole transmission cycle. So what you have is sort of a winnowing of the population that can be infected down in numbers. And as that happens, you run out of people to infect. And so that's the natural process that occurs over the course of the outbreak that results in it first rising as you're burning through people and they're becoming infected, and then it declines over time because you've run out of people to infect. A vaccination short circuits this. It just does the process artificially. It comes in, and by providing some people antigenic material in the form of an inoculant, it induces an antibody response, and those antibodies then provide you the preemptive power to clear the virus from your system without really becoming infectious yourself.
I'm curious, Jeff, there's lots of talk about getting antibody tests for COVID-19, and there's still a lot of questions out about whether or not someone is immune to COVID-19 once they've had the virus. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I would say the big question, or one of the big questions concerning this virus, is are people one and done with it? When they're infected, are they conferred with lifelong immunity against it? Do they have a robust antibody response? Are those going to last? Or do they wane over time or through the processes that have to do with the mutation of the virus over the time? Is the virus able to escape those memory immune components and infect somebody again? So the question is, can you be reinfected? And if so, at what time scale? Is it every year? Is it every 5 years? Is it every 20 years? Those are really important questions for understanding what the circulation of this virus will be going forward.
Apoorva, you know, there are folks who say we can just achieve herd immunity if we just live our lives and don't wear our masks. And, you know, people who get infected will get infected and we'll just kind of get to this naturally. And this is without a vaccine available. Is there a danger in relying on that theory without a vaccine available? Or basically, are more people going to die?
I mean, the danger is deaths, as you've just said. You know, we've already had 177,000 in the United States, and that's with most of the population still not having been exposed to the virus and not having gotten sick. So if we just allowed the virus to run rampant, the cost in human lives and in the cost in long-term effects for people who recover would just be staggering.
How has our understanding of herd immunity shifted from the early days in the pandemic?
So in the early days, epidemiologists were estimating that we would need to have, you know, 60 to 70% of the population be infected with the coronavirus or have gotten a vaccine and be protected, you know, for herd immunity. And that was based on the kinds of calculations that they usually do to figure out what percent of the population needs to be vaccinated. But what we are now thinking, or scientists are now saying, is that when you take into account the fact that people in the population don't all socialize in the same way, don't all have the same vulnerability to the virus. Some people are more vulnerable, for example, older people. Some people socialize more, for example, teenagers and people in their 20s. And when you take all of that kind of variability into account in a mathematical model, the percent that you need to have protection in the population drops from 60 to 70 to something more like 45 to 50%. So it's a little bit lower than we thought, which is overall good news.
Jeff, I want to ask you about Sweden, and I just want to have a disclaimer here that I don't think we can compare the United States to Sweden, but I'm curious about the headlines about Sweden, where some of the country's top Epidemiologists have said that schools should reopen so that children can essentially achieve herd immunity. What do we make of that? And again, with the disclaimer that the United States is 300 million some odd residents compared to Sweden's much smaller population.
Yeah, you know, Sweden only has a population of 10 million, but they're conducting a unique social and epidemiological experiment. Very early on, the Swedish government, in consultation with some epidemiologists, decided that in some sense they were going to go for herd immunity, that they weren't going to disrupt their economy the way some of the other countries in Europe were attempting, and that they were going to let the virus run its course. And what we saw with them, particularly if you were to compare it to neighboring Scandinavian countries like Norway and Denmark, is Sweden has undergone much higher rates of infection and many more deaths. However, they haven't gotten to the point of herd immunity yet, because even though that was the case, they were still doing some things. The government was encouraging people to be careful, but there wasn't a lot of mask usage from the reports that I'd seen, and people were still going to restaurants. But they ultimately did close schools, as I understand, and they have protected nursing homes and long-term care facilities, and the elderly have been sort of shut off. Sort of some of that variability in contacts that Apoorva was talking about is still present within Swedish society. If they're sticking with it still, and they haven't had a huge accumulation of cases recently in the last month, and they're thinking about opening schools, they're pushing the experiment a bit further, because schools are mixing environments. They're little mass gatherings that happen on a daily basis with students, teachers, and staff, and they provide additional opportunities for the virus to pass from person to person. Now, obviously, you can take additional steps to try to control this. You can socially distance, you can thin out the class size, you could encourage mask wearing, etc. But given Sweden's policy, it doesn't sound like they would be doing too much of this. And instead, they were hoping that the virus moves through the student population. And children aren't typically that adversely affected by this virus, though their teachers can be, and let them build up this herd immunity that they've been going for, infect more people, and get them out of circulation so that they can't then pass it on to others once they've recovered.
Question, Jeff, because I am not an epidemiologist. I'm a journalist asking questions that I think a lot of people have here. And I'm wondering, is the theory of herd immunity even realistic? I mean, we have a flu shot every year for the we have not achieved a certain amount of herd immunity with the basic common cold. When we're children, we have to get vaccines for measles and mumps and many other things. And I think lately we've been seeing folks who are challenging the idea of vaccines altogether. Is herd immunity actually achievable in this context, or is it a way for people to challenge the idea of vaccines?
I think you're getting a bit of both. I certainly think people who are opposed to vaccines, anti-vaxxers, even the vaccine hesitant, are going to be looking at this and wondering about safety associated with a vaccine that's rolled out so quickly. However, vaccines are very effective. They have supported our modern society and our lifestyles in the Western world that we have really grown accustomed to. The examples of the common cold and influenza, and the fact that we haven't really been able to curb them, particularly flu with the vaccine, has to do with the same processes I talked about in relationship to COVID-19, simply that this virus, the flu, mutates all the time, and the vaccine isn't particularly effective, unfortunately. And as a result of these two things, people get the virus over and over and over again with a vaccine that's not fully effective. Now, science has been trying to catch up and get that under control so we could have what's called a universal vaccine that's much more effective so people don't have to get the flu, but we're not there yet. But if you were to look at other diseases, things like polio and smallpox, the vaccines we've developed there are highly effective, and they result in lifelong immunity so that people never have to experience those infections. Those are very, very powerful medical tools, and they've been remarkable in their ability to allow us to the ability to control these viruses, and in one case, even eradicate the disease.
Apoorva, is there any reason to be optimistic based on your reporting here? I mean, is there a chance, and I know this is what so many Americans and people around the world want, that this virus might actually, this pandemic might actually end?
I think there is cause for optimism. There are all of these vaccines in development, and vaccines can actually be more effective in inducing herd immunity than natural infection, because we can strengthen the vaccines in ways that we can't tweak the human body. And so, you know, for example, today there were reports this morning that there is a case of reinfection out of Hong Kong. And if that's true, people might say that that means that vaccines won't be effective. But in fact, the opposite is true. If, you know, we are prone to being reinfected with this virus, say after just a few months, it'll be even more important to have a vaccine that can give us a little bit longer lasting immunity. You know, there are things that we can add to vaccines to make sure that they are stronger than an infection would be in getting us to produce a very strong and robust immune response that lasts a certain amount of time. It may be that we need to be vaccinated every year, like we do with the flu vaccine, but at least we'll have those answers in the next few months.
Apoorva Mandavilli is a science reporter at the New York Times, and Jeffrey Shaman is a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Earlier this month, President Trump signed the Great American Outdoors Act into law. It's a bipartisan piece of legislation that puts money towards the maintenance of our national parks, as well as the federal government's Land and Water Conservation Fund. But as we've been covering on the show, national parks have notoriously been accessible to mainly white families in this country. And here's what you had to say about that.
Hi, my name is Jimmy. I'm from Long Beach, California. I'm Black and Mexican, and my family was really into the outdoors. We went camping up in Yosemite and Tom's Place and Kern River all the time. Did a lot of fishing, and I don't know why we're typical city people, but my family just really liked to connect with the outdoors, and almost all of my lessons as a kid were somehow tied into nature.
This is Max. I'm from Bowling Green, Kentucky. As an African American, I was raised by a white family, and I was lucky because I call them Grandma and Grandpa. Grandpa was able to take me camping every so often. I mean, I remember we did that a lot. We went ice fishing, so I really got to enjoy the outdoors.
Some of you said you still felt excluded until later in your life.
My name is Gwen. My husband and I grew up in the segregated South in the 50s, where if there were public parks, we didn't feel welcome. And certainly no public pools where we could learn to swim, like so many Blacks of our era. Today we live in the wonderfully beautiful Pacific Northwest, and as retirees, we've discovered the robust senior recreation program, and in this way, we've been able to go hiking and to some of the most beautiful spots.
You can keep calling us and sharing your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Joining us now is Nikki Brueggemann, a writer and oral historian who recently published the article Why Black People Don't Go Camping on Medium. Nikki, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. So tell us, what led you to write this piece? It sort of coincided with our coverage of this issue, so it's perfect timing.
Yeah. So what really encouraged me to write this piece was that, you know, it's summer, and growing up, summer was the time when my family and I would go camping. And of course, as there is a pandemic, you know, life is a little bit different. So it had me sitting back and thinking about my past summers. And I began to wonder to myself as an African-American woman, well, why didn't I see any other Black people when I was camping when I was younger? Which led me to this Google search and then down this rabbit hole of this realization that camping had been a segregated activity, and it was something that really just kind of slapped me in the face. I grew up believing that our national parks were for the people, and to find out that there had been a time when people like me were not welcomed really just shook me to my core. So that's what encouraged me to write the piece.
Now tell me about how your own experiences with camping and with national parks have evolved over the years.
Well, I was adopted by two parents who were white. So growing up, the national parks were kind of my playground. It was where we went on vacation. It was where I bonded with my parents, especially with my father. And, you know, when I look back at it, I don't remember any incidents of overt racism. But I do remember not seeing anyone who really looked like me. I don't remember seeing anyone in the park service that looked like me. And as I've grown up, I've continued to believe that I have every right to go to the national parks and take part in camping and any of the activities worthy. And I have every right to those things. However, not seeing myself in the national parks has made me feel, as time has gone on, that maybe I'm not as welcomed as I initially had thought. And I think that also in part led to me looking at this history.
One of the things we've been talking about on The Takeaway over the past couple of weeks has been this idea that, you know, the history of the national parks, the lack of information about people of color who have been involved in creating that history, but also just this idea that we, i.e. people of color, Black folk and others, don't go camping. We don't go to these parks. And I think part of that is also because of money. Tell us about how the cost of camping can play into this idea of not going or not being accessible.
Yeah. So I think there are many factors when it comes to camping that many people who do camping, they don't think about what that might mean to a family that is shorter on cash. When I wrote this piece, I had a lot of backlash from people saying, well, this is cheaper than staying in a hotel. And I agree. However, you have to take into consideration many things, like buying a tent can be a couple hundred dollars for a decent tent, buying sleeping bags for a family that will set you back, and buying the other camping essentials, such as maybe a gas stove or maybe firewood. You have to buy food specifically for the trip. And then you have to take into account the costs of traveling, like driving, some wear and tear on your car. So I think that for many people, when I say that camping is expensive, it doesn't resonate, because if you're thinking and comparing it to something like a hotel, of course it is cheaper. But the reality is, for some American families, camping is a leisure expense that cannot be afforded. And I think that when you get the idea in your head that the activity that you do is, of course, affordable for every other American, you are very blinded to the reality that you yourself might have some economic privilege. And I think that's one thing that with camping we sometimes fail to see, is that you do have to have some economic ability. You have to have time off work. You have to have extra money to buy a tent, to buy a space at a campground. And I think that realization is very difficult for many people.
Nikki, we got about a minute left in the segment, and I'm just curious, is there anything that you think, what would you say to people who, to Black people in particular, to Latinos and other folks who just don't think the outdoors and camping is for them? How do we better introduce people of color to the outdoors?
Well, I think that the first thing for us to do is to acknowledge the past. And so when people come to me and say, well, that's a white people thing, the reaction I've developed now is, well, is that a white people thing? Or is that something that we've been denied and not allowed to participate in? And I think that as we talk about how do we get people of color into camping and into the outdoors, we need as a nation to sit down and address our past of segregation. We need to sit down and address the fact that we have not been a diverse and welcoming place in the great outdoors. And I think as we begin to do that and we put that message of welcoming out to communities of color through things like having a more diverse national service, I think that is how we begin that process.
Nikki Brueggemann is a writer and oral historian. Nikki, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Monday's over. I got a lot more stuff to come this week, so make sure you don't miss any days with us here on The Takeaway. And I want to welcome our new listeners at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California. We are so excited to be a part of your day. And just to let you folks know, there's a few good ways to reach us. You can talk to us on Twitter at The Takeaway. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Leave us a message on any topic. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.